Chapter 9, Byzantium, 395 to 1453. The story of the Byzantine Empire is a bridge that spans a great gulf of human history, from the classical era to the dawn of the early modern world. In many ways, it is the defining story of the Middle Ages. It began with an unassuming Greek colony on the Bosphorus named Byzantion, supposedly founded by a prince of Megara named Byzas. Around 667 BCE, the oracle at Delphi told Byzas to set sail from his home and settle in the land opposite the city of the blind. As he sailed through the Bosphorus Strait on his way into the Black Sea, Byzas sighted a Greek colony on the Asian side called Chalcedon, but he immediately saw that the European side was a much better place to settle, a defensible position with a large natural harbor. The settlers of Chalcedon had been blind to miss this perfect spot. Prince Byzas landed opposite the City of the Blind and named his new city Byzantion after himself. Over the centuries, this city would wear many other names: Nova Roma, Constantinople, Dersadet, Constantinie, Stamboul, and today we know it as Istanbul. The advantages that Byzas had seen in the location were indeed formidable. It stood at the narrowest point of the Bosphorus Strait, a natural crossing point that controlled all shipping traffic between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean, as well as land-based trade ferried between the continents. What was more, the swift currents that flowed through the narrow channel would make it difficult for any army to attack by sea. The harbor was a long sliver of river estuary, sheltered from the currents and large enough to hold thousands of ships, that would come to be known as the Golden Horn, thanks either to the enormous wealth that would flow through it in the centuries to come, or to the rich yellow light that would often blaze on its surface as the sun set over the sea. Byzantion was established as a perfect wedge shape, nestled between the Golden Horn and the Sea of Marmara, and any attackers who wanted to take the city had only a single approach by land. It was the perfect spot to build a fortress that would become virtually unassailable. Byzantion's importance would only grow during the late Roman period, as the power of Europe's largest empire faltered. By the end of the 3rd century, this vast Mediterranean power could no longer be ruled from the city that had given birth to it. Rome was crippled by corruption, and its people increasingly suffered from a disease that they believed was caused by bad air, or mal aria in Latin, which we know today as malaria. In 285, Emperor Diocletian split the empire into two administrative regions, with Western Europe and Western North Africa comprising the Western Empire, with its capital at Mediolanum, or modern Milan, and the wealthier eastern regions of Greece, Turkey, Syria, the Levant, and Egypt, forming the Eastern Empire. In the hope of ending the divisions and civil wars that had racked the empire, each half would be governed by two rulers apiece, in a system known as the Tetrarchy, or Rule of Four. But the Tetrarchy soon fell apart, and another devastating civil war raged. Emperor Constantine, crowned in the British city of York, fought with his rivals Maxentius and Licinius over who would rule. During this 20-year conflict, Constantine made a remarkable conversion to the young Eastern religion of Christianity. When he emerged victorious and united the whole empire once more, he decided to construct a new capital in the east. He considered various options, but in 330 CE, he settled on the small trading city of Byzantion, which sat at the point where Europe and Asia meet. Like the ancient explorer Byzus, Constantine saw his own reflection in this golden city. He renamed Byzantion after himself, calling it Constantinopolis, and it was also known informally as Nova Roma, or New Rome. Constantine immediately began an enormous building project, with the goal of turning Constantinople into a worthy imperial capital. He laid out a new central square, naming it the Augustaeum, with a senate house in a grand basilica on the east side, and the great palace of the emperor to the south. Nearby was the hippodrome for chariot races, its track 450 meters long, with stands for up to 100,000 spectators. The approach to this racetrack was adorned with a 32-meter obelisk, exactly the same height as the one that stood in the Circus Maximus in Rome. A clear statement that Constantinople was every bit the equal of the Eternal City. Constantine also built an imposing city wall running between the Golden Horn and the Sea of Marmara. The city would grow fast, and by the beginning of the 5th century, it was already spilling out beyond Constantine's walls, and a new series of defences would soon have to be built. Today, we can trace the success of the city in the advancing rings of its walls, growing outwards like the rings of a tree. But these walls also testify to the increasingly dangerous world that surrounded the young capital. In the West, Rome's power was faltering. Civil wars like the rebellion of Magnus Maximus had bled the empire white and emptied its treasuries, and far-flung provinces like Britannia were throwing off its rule. What's more, in 410 CE, 2 years into his reign, the Eastern Emperor Theodosius received news of an unthinkable tragedy. An army of Goths led by the general Alaric had laid siege to the city of Rome 3 times, and on the 3rd had burst over its walls and sacked the city. While no longer the empire's capital, this was still an act that shocked the world. A barbarian storm of which prophecies long ago spoke fell upon Rome, wrote Bishop Palladius in 420. And it did not even spare the bronze statues in the forum. Plundering with barbarian madness, it destroyed everything. Thus Rome, beautified for 1,200 years, became a ruin. Starving and desperate refugees fled across the Mediterranean to Africa. Saint Jerome, a Western native now living in Bethlehem, lamented, "Who would believe that Rome, built up by the conquest of the whole world, had collapsed, that the mother of nations had become also their tomb, that the shores of the whole East, of Egypt, of Africa, which once belonged to the imperial city, were filled with the hosts of her manservants and maidservants." Theodosius was determined that Constantinople would not follow the fate of Rome. He ordered the construction of a series of walls around the city that were among the most imposing defensive structures ever built. A ring of 3 concentric walls, each taller than the last, with an enormous moat before them which could be flooded on demand. The innermost wall was almost 5 meters thick and included 96 towers, each 20 meters tall. The city gate was built of marble, topped with a magnificent sculpture of a chariot pulled by 4 elephants. These walls were so formidable that they would not be breached for 1,000 years, and it would take a complete revolution in military technology to do it. Despite the administrative division between East and West, most Romans of the time didn't consider the empire to have been split. The terms Western and Eastern Roman Empire were coined in modern times to describe these two political entities, but for much of their shared history, the Romans of both halves of the empire went on viewing it as a single entity. Still, there were significant divisions between them. The overwhelming culture of the Eastern Empire was Greek, and throughout its history, Greek was the language of its administrators and city dwellers, while the Western Romans spoke Latin. But the people of the Byzantine Empire seldom referred to themselves as Greek, and even the term Byzantine is a much later invention. Until the end of their history, right through the Middle Ages, the people referred to themselves as Romans, and their lands as Romania. Byzantine rulers were in fact greatly offended whenever their rivals in the Holy Roman Empire tried to diminish their claims by referring to them as Emperor of the Greeks. While it was no longer the capital of the Western Empire, at the end of the 4th century, Rome had still been its symbolic heart, an economic powerhouse, and the home of an immensely rich aristocracy. But with the destruction of the 5th century, its position wavered. A second sacking of the city by the Vandals in 455 once again halved the population, and by this time Rome's influence extended no further than the borders of the Italian peninsula. Wealth no longer flowed to it from the rest of its empire, and the complex economic web it had spun began to unravel. A revolt by Germanic mercenary troops known as the Heruli finally toppled this vestige, and the remnants of the Roman army were defeated at the Battle of Ravenna in 476. The emperor was forced to resign, and the Western Roman Empire vanished as a political entity entirely. Writing from the east, Saint Jerome encapsulates what must have been the fear and uncertainty of that time. What is safe if Rome perishes? Throughout this period of Western crisis, Constantinople flourished. It continued to grow in size and importance, becoming the undisputed capital and center of the Mediterranean world. Throughout the whole period of Rome's collapse, the East was seen as a safe haven and received an influx of refugees. This was the beginning of the city's role as a sanctuary to the destitute, the city that the poet Nicetas Coniates would later refer to as the beloved refuge of strangers, queen of the queens of cities. Song of songs and splendor of splendors. The eastern half of the empire weathered the tremors of the 5th century well. It endured Hun and Ostrogoth invasions and was plagued by Vandal pirates, but suffered no permanent damage. In the east, the frontier with the Persian Sassanids held. For Constantinople, the closest call came in early 447, when the strongest earthquake in living memory ravaged the area, collapsing a section of the Theodosian walls at the exact moment that an army of Huns led by Attila was marching towards the city. The walls, which had taken 9 years to build, would have to be repaired in only a few months. The man in charge of this near impossible task, a prefect called Constantinus, knew that the city had one great untapped resource, its immense spirit of competition. In Constantinople, chariot racing held people's fanatic devotion the same way that sports teams do today. Four teams raced in the sands of the Hippodrome, the reds, whites, greens, and blues, and bitter rivalries existed between their supporters. Riots and even deaths were not uncommon at the racecourse when rival gangs met. With Attila's hordes descending on the city and the walls in ruins, Constantinus went down to the Hippodrome, raised his hands, and made a simple announcement. Each team's fans would be given a section of the wall to rebuild, and they had to gather as many of their supporters to help as they could. The declaration of a competition was clear and irresistible, and more than 16,000 fans gathered to repair the city walls. We can imagine the frenzy of activity as these masses climbed the scaffolding with stone, brick, and mortar, singing their team songs and jeering at their rivals as, together, they rebuilt their fallen walls. We can imagine the look on the face of Attila when he arrived at the gates of Constantinople and found not the earthquake-crumbled ruin that his scouts had promised, but a triple line of defensive walls, their limestone glistening white in the sun, the strongest fortification in the known world. The Huns, unable to take the city, were happy to be paid off, and Constantinople was saved. The Eastern Empire's success and survival was such that in the 6th century, one man would go on a crusade to recover the fragmented lands it had once governed, and even recapture Rome itself. His name was Justinian. Justinian inherited the Byzantine throne from his uncle Justin in 527 CE. Quite remarkably, Justin had begun his life as a swineherd in Dardania, a mountainous region in the Balkans. He had come to Constantinople as a refugee before rising through the ranks of the palace guard, eventually becoming a senator, then commander of the palace guard, and then emperor. After this, he brought his young nephew, the boy Justinian, to the capital to be educated. After his uncle's death, Justinian became emperor in turn and set about the job of ruling with unmatched energy. He became known as the emperor who never sleeps, but contemporary sources also indicate that he had a controversial character. He caused a scandal by marrying Theodora, a lower-class courtesan with a lascivious reputation. The 6th-century historian Procopius of Caesarea even wrote one damning text entitled Anecdota, a tell-all purporting to reveal the true Justinian and Theodora, a text that has come to be known as the Secret History. Here, Procopius portrays Justinian as cruel, incompetent, and petty. He carried out an indefinite number of murders to accomplish these ends, for in his eagerness to gather all men into one belief as to Christ, he kept destroying the rest of mankind in senseless fashion, and that too while acting with a pretense of piety. For it did not seem to him murder if the victims chanced to be not of his own creed. Procopius even goes so far as to claim that Justinian and his wife were possessed by evil spirits and wandered the halls at night without their heads. In the early days of his reign, Justinian resolved to renovate the city and ordered plans to be drawn up for a new church that would rival the now dilapidated St. Peter's tomb in Rome, bringing marbles from all over the empire for its construction. The result was one of the world's most remarkable buildings. Its dome rises 55 meters with a span of 30 meters. The Church of St. Sophia, or Hagia Sophia, is still one of Istanbul's most recognizable landmarks. Justinian was also determined to increase the economic potential of his empire, which led him to commit what is perhaps history's first act of corporate espionage. For centuries, silk had been the sole preserve of Chinese craftsmen, and its manufacture was a jealously guarded secret. But in 551, two Byzantine monks who had been preaching in India journeyed on to China, where they observed the technologies and intricate methods used in the raising of silkworms and the production of silk. Back in Constantinople, Justinian offered the monks a fortune if they were able to smuggle some of these mysterious worms back to the capital. These monks set out again for China, this time carrying hollow bamboo canes with hidden compartments inside. There they convinced others to smuggle the silkworms out for them, brought them home, and eventually established a breeding population. Their actions began a Byzantine trade in silk, with silk factories setting up in Constantinople, Beirut, Antioch, and Thebes. They quickly established a monopoly on silk in Europe, and this formed one of the bases for their economy throughout the medieval period, swelling the empire's wealth. This is just one example of the exchange of technologies that took place along these routes. But Justinian had even greater ambitions. He wanted to recover all the lands of the Western Roman Empire, a project he called Renovatio Imperii, the restoration of the empire. Justinian's army, headed by a general named Belisarius, marched across North Africa and conquered the Vandals who occupied it in only 9 months. Then they set their sights on Italy, where an Ostrogoth king still ruled. Belisarius swept through Italy and laid siege to the city of Rome for a year, finally marching through its gates and taking it in 536. From his throne in Constantinople, Justinian watched as the lands of old Rome fell once more under his banner. When Belisarius marched into Rome, he would have seen its grandeur much faded. Earthquakes had damaged many of its buildings, but its aqueducts were still running, and its baths still functioned. A threadbare population had begun to reclaim some of their importance in the region, if nothing like the total dominion they had once exercised. For Justinian and Belisarius, Rome was the ultimate symbol of the revitalized empire, and they would not give it up for anything. The years that followed saw a series of long and costly wars against the Ostrogoths, and while they succeeded in reclaiming Rome, the Byzantines also did immense damage to the Eternal City. In these wars, as much as 90% of Rome's citizens either died or fled, leaving a population of perhaps only 30,000 people. Of the 13 aqueducts that had once carried water directly into the city, only 2 remained in operation. Ironically, if there had ever been hope of rebuilding Rome to the glory of its ancient past, then the Byzantines under Belisarius had ended that hope forever. The conquests of Justinian, though remarkable, were short-lived. The Byzantine Empire simply didn't have the resources to maintain such a large empire for any length of time. The Gothic Wars drained its wealth and distracted its military forces. Meanwhile, the 540s brought the first known outbreak of bubonic plague in West Eurasian history, the so-called Plague of Justinian. This pandemic would kill anywhere between 25 to 100 million people over the next 2 centuries. Justinian is even reported to have contracted the disease, although he was one of the approximately half of all people who recovered. The plague weakened the Byzantine Empire at a critical point, and in 568, the Germanic people called the Lombards invaded northern Italy, defeated the small Byzantine army left there, and established their own kingdom. The dream of resurrecting the ancient empire was dead. Justinian died in 565, leaving no children. He had inherited an imperial treasury of 29 million gold coins, but his wars had all but bankrupted the state. Even his architectural legacy, the Hagia Sophia, had seen its dome collapse in 558 after being weakened by an earthquake the year before, an event that must have seemed to some like God's judgment on an emperor whose lofty ambitions had fallen so short. Soon, cracks would begin to show in the empire too. In the east, Byzantium was under pressure from the powerful Sassanids. a Persian empire that ruled from the city of Ctesiphon, near modern Baghdad. Wars with this rival sometimes dragged on for decades, weakening both empires, and usually resulting in bitter, costly stalemates. In Europe, they would also be pressed by the Bulgarian Empire and other rivals. Byzantium's position at the crossroads of continents gave it unique advantages, but it also presented this obvious challenge. The empire had frontiers in Europe and in Asia, and its enemies in both the East and West felt emboldened to attack while its back was turned. In the early 7th century, for example, the Emperor General Heraclius had great successes in Asia, routing experienced Persian generals and recovering large amounts of territory. But he soon had to give it all up and march back to Constantinople to repel an army of Avars advancing on the capital from Europe. For the empire, wolves were always approaching from both directions, and soon a new rival would arise out of an unlikely quarter, the seemingly empty desert sands of Arabia. In Arabia in the early 600s, a warrior visionary known to history as Muhammad rose to topple the established powers of the region and gathered a powerful military force around him. After his death in 632, the successors of Muhammad spread out of the Arabian Peninsula and swept into the lands of both the Sassanids and the Byzantines, both weakened by their constant wars with one another. To the shock of the world, the Arab advance from the south resulted in the disintegration of the Sassanid Empire. For the Byzantines, this came as a complete surprise. In 634, the Arabs defeated a Byzantine force sent into Syria and captured Damascus. The holy city of Jerusalem followed soon after in 637, a disaster for the Christian Byzantines that would remain a sore point for centuries to come. The Arabs quickly swallowed up Byzantine territories in Asia Minor before taking Egypt, the former breadbasket of the empire. Muslim forces next set their ambitions to the sea and built a navy strong enough to raid the islands of Cyprus and Rhodes, and to destroy 500 Byzantine ships on the sea. The former Roman province of Carthage fell around 647. By 674, the Muslims even felt bold enough to make a strike at the great city of Constantinople itself. The Arab attack was daring, but it was also methodical. Their fleet began by capturing port towns along the coast, and then setting up a blockade of Constantinople, attempting to stifle the city. In this year, in March, a rainbow appeared in the sky, and all mankind shuddered, wrote the 8th century abbot and chronicler Theophanes the Confessor. Everyone said it was the end of the world. In this year, the deniers of Christ readied a great expedition. But the Byzantines had one more trick up their sleeve: a mysterious superweapon of terrifying power. The secrets of this substance were guarded so closely that even today there is lively debate over its composition. It would be named after the Greek Byzantines who developed it, and so it would be known as Greek fire. Incendiary weapons had been used in warfare for centuries before, but Greek fire was different. It was developed by a man named Kallinikos, who had fled the Arab conquests and come to Constantinople, that refuge of strangers. Greek fire was an extremely inflammable substance, possibly based on petroleum, that set even the surface of the sea ablaze. Water could not douse the flames, and by some accounts even made them more intense. The substance was dispensed in liquid form, often through siphons or copper piping, and its use was accompanied with smoke and the sounds of thunder. Greek fire took the Muslim fleet by surprise, and their ships burned in the waters of the Sea of Marmara. Their defeat at sea was coupled with a Byzantine victory on land, and the Arab forces were repelled, having suffered enormous losses. Growing division in Muslim lands soon forced them to attend to their own affairs, and a peace deal was struck. Against all the odds, Byzantium had survived once again. Over the next centuries, storm after storm would rage against the city of Constantinople, but it always held. Its powerful walls, its natural defenses, and the ingenious invention of Greek fire kept it safe. For this reason, Byzantium, as a successor state to the Roman Empire, survived into the height of the Middle Ages and became the undisputed center of the medieval world. For the Byzantine people, their capital was a constant source of pride. They called it the Eye of the World, or the Reigning City. Its banner, the Byzantine crescent moon, would have fluttered and snapped over its rooftops and countless churches and icon houses. Visitors would have wandered down narrow streets between buildings of orange-brown bricks, still manufactured with Roman methods. Bronze church bells would have rung out among the calling of sea birds and the clatter of wooden window shutters. Dozens of languages were heard on its streets, as one 10th-century knight, Bartolf of Nangis, recorded. "In this city are Greeks, Bulgarians, Alans, Comans, Pigmaticans, Italians, Venetians, Romanians, Dacians, English, Amalfitans, even Turks. Many heathen peoples, Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabs, and people of all nations come together here." Behind studded iron doors, large houses enclosed courtyards with stables, cattle sheds, chicken coops and storerooms. Many wealthier homes were also centrally heated, using a hypocaust system inherited from the ancient Romans, although most relied on the heat given off by charcoal braziers. The kitchens usually contained a low hearth with a square pipe forming a chimney above. During the day, the skyline must have been fogged with wood smoke from these chimneys. Many houses even had sewage systems that led out to the sea. Performers would have plied their trades in the streets, acrobats, jugglers, and fire eaters. A bishop of Cremona, visiting in 949, describes one of these performances. "A man carried on his head, without using his hands, a wooden pole 24 feet or more long. Then two boys appeared who went up the pole, did various tricks on it, and then came down head first, keeping the pole all the time as steady as though it were rooted in the earth, which filled me with great astonishment and admiration." But of course, being poor in Constantinople was a pretty miserable existence. From the 5th century onwards, skyscraper blocks of flats of 5 to 9 stories were built to serve as tenements for working people, just like in a modern city. These quarters were usually little better than slums. "Constantinople is a city of extremes," wrote Odo of Douay, a visitor who passed through in 1147. "She surpasses other cities in wealth, and she surpasses them in vice. She is squalid and fetid, and in many places afflicted by permanent darkness, for the wealthy overshadow the streets with buildings and leave these dirty, dark places to the poor." Constantinople was famous for its spice markets and perfumeries. "Each market has gates which are closed upon it at night," one visitor wrote. "The majority of the artisans and salespeople in them are women." Another extract from the Book of the Epoch, a handbook of city guild regulations dating to 895, gives a sense of the heady aromas of these markets. Let them sell pepper, spikenard, cinnamon, aloes wood, amber, musk, incense, myrrh, balsam, indigo, sweet-smelling herbs, mint. In short, any article which is used for perfumery or for dyeing. Let their counters stand above the bronze portico, so that the sweet perfume may waft upwards and permeate the vestibule of the imperial palace. Anyone contravening these rules shall be flogged, shaved, and banished. On the days when imperial processions and religious ceremonies were held, the unpleasant smells of the medieval city were masked with wreaths of rosemary and pine chips, with rose petals and marjoram. But above all, visitors to the city were awestruck by its sheer size and magnificence. At 500,000 people, it was the largest city that Europeans would ever see. In the mid-10th century, the poet Constantinos of Rhodes wrote about the effect it had. After a long and wearisome journey, the traveller sees from a distance towers rising high into the air, and like strong giants in stride, columns that rise up to the highest point, and tall houses and temples whose vast roofs reach to the heights. Who would not become instantly filled with joy? And when he reaches the wall and draws near to the gates, who does not greet the city, lower his neck, kneel to the ground, and grasp the famous earth? But over the centuries, the world around Constantinople had changed. In Western Europe, the post-Roman era had given way to the Middle Ages, and the continent now comprised a patchwork of kingdoms whose people seemed crude to the sophisticated Byzantines. In Western Europe, a feudal system now dictated that the lords and ladies of the land were born into their right to rule. There it was impossible for peasants to rise above their stations, but in Byzantium there was no legal status given to nobles. Great families could fall, and others, such as Justinian's, could rise out of nowhere. Over its history, 4 emperors of Byzantium were women. In the intervening years, the ancient capital of Rome had risen once again, not as an imperial power, but as the centre of Roman Catholicism and the seat of the Pope. Though the people of Western Europe spoke many different languages, they were united by their relationship to this Latin church. The differences in translation between the Greek and Latin religious texts naturally led to disagreement between the branches of Christianity, some of them exceedingly bitter. In 1054, an event known as the East-West Schism tore the Christian world down the middle. All Latin churches in Constantinople were shut down, and excommunications were fired like volleys of arrows from one side of Europe to another. This rift only grew wider as time went on. Having discovered how costly wars could be, the Byzantine Empire now preferred, where possible, not to fight. In the centuries following the rise of Islam, it became exceptional at projecting what we might call soft power. Foreign kings were allowed to compete for the hands of Byzantine princesses and to be given honorific titles of the empire. Many sent their young princes to be educated among the empire's sophisticated aristocracy. The Byzantines were expert at creating extravagant ceremonies that impressed and overwhelmed the ambassadors of foreign powers. The historian Antony Kaldelis recounts the visit of one delegation from Asia Minor in the year 946 CE. The reception hall and its surroundings were decked out with silk hangings, laurel wreaths and flowers and silver chains, and the hall was covered with Persian carpets and sprinkled with rosewater. The entire court, thousands of people, stood in a prescribed order in full ceremonial regalia. Acclamations were chanted to the accompaniment of organs, and the emperor sat on a throne that was imagined to be a replica of that of the Old Testament King Solomon. It was flanked by mechanical moving animals, including roaring lions and warbling birds, and could be lifted up into the air while the envoys were prostrate on the floor. All this theatre served to impress and terrify foreign delegations. It projected one simple message: you have arrived in the capital of the empire, the new Rome, the eye of the world. And, of course, when soft power failed, there was always the Byzantine army. In the mid-10th century, this was a formidable force of roughly 140,000 soldiers, or about 5% of all adult males in the empire. To supplement this, the Byzantines also employed foreign mercenaries, usually small amounts of specialized soldiers from neighboring lands. But usually the Byzantines' most powerful military asset was their capital, the unconquerable city of Constantinople. Over the centuries, they had increased its siege defenses even further and constructed several hundred enormous underground water cisterns, so that they would never go thirsty during even the longest sieges. Just as impressive were the three open-air cisterns built near the Theodosian walls, which held a combined 600,000 cubic meters of water. Today, one of these vast cisterns houses a football stadium. The Byzantines also created an enormous iron chain, its links as thick as a man's arm, that could be winched across the entrance to the estuary of the Golden Horn, barring entry to the port. Time and again, the Byzantines would fall back to the defenses of their city, and there no attacker was able to defeat them. But through the 11th century, a new threat was rising that would ultimately force the empire into a difficult and painful compromise, and lead, in the coming centuries, to the ruin and waste of their great capital. This threat came in the form of the Seljuk Turks.